This is East End Inc. James Joyce's novel Ulysses was published in 1922. It takes place on June 16th of 1904. The date is celebrated yearly as Bloomsday, named after the book's protagonist, Leopold Bloom. Tonight we present a celebration of Bloomsday, as recorded at Sag Harbor's John Germain Library on Thursday, June 16th, 2022. The presenters were Joseph Shaw, the executive director of the Express News Group of Sag Harbor and Southampton, stage and screen actor Paul McIsaac, impresario Peter Walsh, and actor Kate Muth of the group Neopolitical Cowgirls.
Let's start with the beginning, which I think is one of the great beginnings to a book ever, just for how evocative it is. But it's also just completely readable. So I'm going to let Peter show you how readable it is.
Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown ungirdled was sustained gently behind him on the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, "Intorio pro artare dei." Halted, he peered down the dark winding stairs and called out coarsely, "Come up, Kinch! Come up, you fearful Jesuit!" Solemnly, he came forward and mounted the round gunrest. He faced about and blessed gravely thrice the tower, the surrounding land, and the awaking mountains. Then, catching sight of Stephen Dedalus, he bent towards him and made rapid crosses in the air, gurgling in his throat and shaking his head. Stephen Dedalus, displeased and sleepy, leaned his arms on top of the staircase and looked coldly at the shaking, gurgling face that blessed him, grained and hewed like pale oak. Buck Mulligan peeped an instant under the mirror, then covered the bowl smartly. "To the barracks," he said sternly. He added in a preacher's tone, "For this, our dearly beloved, is the genuine Christine. Body and soul and blood and wound." "Slow music, please. Shut your eyes, gents. One moment. A little trouble about those white corpuscles. Silence, all." He peered sideways, up, and gave a long, slow whistle of a call, then paused a while in rapt attention, his even white teeth glistening here and then with gold points, chrysotomos. Two strong, shrill whistles answered through the calm. "Thanks, old chap," he cried briskly. "That will do nicely. Hey, switch off the current, will you?" He skipped off the gunrest and looked gravely at his watcher, gathering about his legs the loose folds of his gown. The plump, shadowed face and sullen, oval jowl recalled a prelate patron of the arts in the Middle Ages. A pleasant smile broke quietly over his lips. "The mockery of it all," he said gaily. "Your absurd name, an ancient Greek." He pointed his finger in friendly jest and went over to the parapet laughing to himself. Stephen Dedalus stepped up, followed him wearily halfway, and sat down on the edge of the gunrest, watching him still as he propped his mirror on the parapet, dipped the brush in the bowl, and lathered cheeks and neck. Buck Mulligan's gay voice went on, "My name's absurd, too. Malachi Mulligan, two dactyls. But it has a Hellenic ring, hasn't it? Tripping and sunny like the buck himself. We must go to Athens. Will you come if I can get the antifork over 20 quid? He laid the brush aside and, laughing with delight, cried, "Will he come, the Jesuit? Ceasing, he began to shave with care. "And tell me, Mulligan," Stephen said quietly.
"Yes, my love." "How long is Haynes going to stay in this tower?"
Buck Mulligan showed a shaven cheek over the red shoulder. "God, isn't he dreadful?" he said frankly.
A ponderous Saxon. He thinks you're not a gentleman. God, these bloody English. Boasting with money and indigestion because he comes from Oxford. You know, Daedalus, you have a real Oxford manner. He can't make you out. Oh, my name for you is the best. Kinch, the knife blade.
What I learned is that the Great Famine is never mentioned in the Ulysses book, in Ulysses. Joyce was one generation from a million people starving to death where he lived. His parents and the older people around him had lived through the starvation of a million people and more than a million people leaving Ireland. Nobody talked about it. And the fascinating thing about it, and I learned that in preparing to read this, is this book is filled with food. And it's filled with, like, as we all know, that food is more than food. It's more than sustenance. It's this, and Joyce's language is so perfect for food. And the fact that we have a book which has such freedom, it has also an undercurrent of something we can't talk about, which was the Great Famine. Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. He liked giblet soup, nutty gizzards, a stuffed roast heart, liver slices fried with crush crumbs, fried hencock rolls. Most of all, he liked grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine, tangy, faint scent of urine. Kidneys were on his mind as he moved about the kitchen softly, writing her breakfast things on the bumpy tray. Gilded light and air were in the kitchen, but outdoors, gentle summer morning everywhere, made him feel a bit peckish, hungry, peckish. The coals were reddening. Another slice of bread and butter. These four right there, she don't like too much on the plate. He turned from the tray, lifted the kettle off the hob, and set it sideways on the fire. It sat there, dull and squat. Its spout stuck out. Cup of tea, good. Mouth dry. The cat walked stiffly around a leg of the table with tail on high. Oh, there you are, Mr. Bloom said, turning from the fire. The cat mewed in answer and stalked stiffly again around the leg of the table, mewing. Yeah, just how she mews and goes around my writing table. Purr, scratch my head, purr. Mr. Bloom watched curiously, kindly, the little black form, clean to see. The gloss of her sleek hide, the white button under the butt of her tail, the green flashing eyes. He bent down to her, his hands on his knees. Milk for pussins, he said. Brrr, the cat cried. They call them stupid. They understand what we say better than we understand them. She understands all she wants. And vindictive, too. Cruel, her nature. Curious. Mice never squeal. Seem to like it. Wonder what I look like to her. Height of a tower? No, she can jump on me. Afraid of the chicken, she is, he said mockingly, afraid of the cuckoos. I never saw such a stupid pussins as this pussins. Brrr, the cat said loudly. She blinked up out of her avid, shame-closing eyes, mewing plaintively, with long, slow, milk-white teeth showing. He watched the dark eyelids narrowing with greed till her eyes were green stones. Then he went to the dresser. He took the jug Marlin's milkman had just filled for him, poured warm bubbled milk on a saucer, and set it slowly on the floor. Grrr, she said, running up to lap. He watched the bristles shining wirily in the weak light as she tipped three times and then licked lightly. Wonder, is it true that you clip them? They can't mouse after that? Why? They shine in the dark, perhaps? The tips? Or kind of feelers in the dark, perhaps? He listened to her licking laugh. Ah, ham and eggs. No. No good eggs with this drought we're in. Wants pure water. Thursday, not a good day either for a mutton kidney at Buckley's. Fried with butter, a shake of pepper. Better a pork kidney at Gallus while the kettle's boiling. She lapped slower, then licking the saucer clean. Why are their tongues so rough? A lap better with those little holes? Nothing here she can eat, no. On quietly creaking boots, he went up the staircase to the hall and paused by the bedroom door. She might like something tasty. Like bread and butter, she likes that in the morning. Still, perhaps, he said softly in the bare hall, I'm going down to the corner, be back in a minute. And when he had heard his own voice, he added, you don't want anything for breakfast? A sleepy, soft grunt answered, No, she didn't want anything.
This is East Intink. We are listening to Sag Harbor's celebration of Bloomsday, as recorded at Sag Harbor's John Germain Library on June 16th, 2022.
But there's a couple of chapters that are really tricky. One is called Oxen of the Sun, which I'm not even going to begin to try and describe, but it's basically Joyce's attempt to show language being born because it takes place at the birthing hospital.
But what I do love about it is that deep within this play with language and different languages coming in, and you're like, I'm speaking in tongues. And there are these riveting questions that bubble up about the Irishness and the Catholicness of the dilemma of when a woman is in jeopardy as she's giving birth, and the men in the room have to decide, are we going to save the mother's life or the child's life? And I guess one thing that I love about, like, he brings up throughout this book so many questions that we're still looking at. God knows why, but that, I mean, in some cases we do, right? We have to. It's, every story is unique when you come into the idea of birthing. It's also unique for each person. But I love it that overlay of how language is being born while he's in, on this one day, he's now in a birthing hospital, and they're talking about this dilemma of this woman being stuck in labor for a very long time. Mm-hmm.
Last chapter of the book is known as Penelope, and it's Odysseus' relative is the return of Odysseus And in the last chapter, Leopold Bloom returns to Molly Bloom's bed, which still bears traces of Blazes Boylan, who was there at 4 o'clock. But this is the only chapter in the book where we hear from Molly Bloom, his wife. And it is a long, unbroken monologue. There is no punctuation.
Six sentences total?
Eight. Almost no punctuation. Mm-hmm. Arnold Bennett, who was an English writer, and he was a contemporary of Joyce's, his quote was, "I have never read anything to surpass it, and I doubt if I have ever read anything to equal it." It really is an amazing thing. And before you read, Kate, I want to talk about the fact that a man wrote this chapter capturing a woman's mind in the way he did. So is this feminist, or should we be angry about him doing this? Or how do you parse that with you know, feminism and having a man do that?
I'm okay with it personally. I don't get angry about people writing things like this. Look, everyone's got their sovereign right to write what they're thinking or feeling, and it's brilliant. I think it's brilliant. As a woman, I know there are some feminists who would slap me down for that, but I do. I mean, I think it's, I mean, when you hear it, it's for me, this whole thing boils down to nature. To nature. And Molly is a force of nature. Like, force of nature, yes, but she is nature personified. She thinks a lot, and this is really all that's happening in her head, all of this stream of consciousness. And she doesn't, I don't feel like she really questions herself or doubts herself. She just is. And that's what I love about her. And I think as an actor, as a human, I think that's what we all should strive to be. And it's not about whether I agree with this or disagree with it or think it's right or wrong, but that don't we all just want to be, and to be so fully free that we can speak and think and do and live our imperfection. And so I don't get angry about this. I like art, and unless they're hurting somebody else, right? I mean, I don't have much patience with racism or bigotry or, you know, any of that. But, you know, he's saying it as it is and as he sees. And I think it's quite, I go, wow.
To set the stage, this is wonderful. Molly falling asleep.
Yeah.
In her bed.
After
the day she had.
Yeah.
When she slept with Blazes Boylan. Mm-hmm. And I would say that coming to this final chapter, the first reader of this book, if you're coming through it the first time, you might picture a sad ending coming, because this may be a book about the dissolution of a marriage. It looks like a marriage breaking apart, but that's what makes this last part just so amazing.
I love flowers. I'd love to have the whole place swimming in roses. God of heaven, there's nothing like nature. The wild mountains, then the sea and the waves rushing, then the beautiful country with fields of oats and wheat and all kinds of things. And all the fine cattle going about, oh, that would do your heart good to see rivers and lakes and flowers, all sorts of shapes and smells and colors springing up even out of the ditches. Primroses and violets. Nature it is. As for them saying there's no God, I wouldn't give a snap of my two fingers for all their learning. Why don't they go and create something, I often asked him. Atheists, or whatever they call themselves, go and wash the cobbles off themselves first, and then they go howling for the priest, and they dying, and why? Why? Because they're afraid of hell on account of their bad conscience. Ah, yes, oh, I know them well. What's the first person in the universe before there was anybody that made it all. Who? That they don't know. Neither do I, so there you are. They might as well try to stop the sun from rising tomorrow. The sun shines for you, he said, the day we were lying among the rhododendrons on Hoth Head in the grey tweed suit and a straw hat, the day I got him to propose to me. Yes. First I gave him the bit of seed cake out of my mouth. And it was leap year like now. 16 years ago, my God. After that long kiss, I near lost my breath, yes. He said, I was a flower of the mountain, yes. So we are flowers all. A woman's body, yes. That was one true thing he said in his life. And the sun shines for you today, yes. That was why I liked him, because I saw he understood or felt what a woman is. And I knew I could always get around him. And I gave him all the pleasure I could, leading him on till he asked me to say yes, and I wouldn't answer first, only looked out over the sea and the sky. I was thinking of so many things he didn't know of. Mulvey and Mr. Stanhope and Hester and Father and old Captain Groves and the sailors playing All Birds Fly and I Say Stoop and Washing Up Dishes, they call it, on the pier, and the sentry in front of the governor's house with the thing round his white helmet, oh, poor devil, half roasted, and the Spanish girls laughing in their shawls and their tall combs, and the auctions in the morning, the Greeks and the Jews and the Arabs and the devil knows who else from all the ends of Europe, and Duke Street and the Fowler Market all clucking outside the Larby Sharon's, and oh, the poor donkey slipping half asleep, and the vague fellows in the cloaks asleep in the shade on the steps, and the big wheels of the carts of the bulls and the old castle, thousands of years old, yes, and those handsome moors all in white and turbans like kings asking you to sit down in their little bit of a shop, and Rhonda with the old windows of the posadas, glancing eyes, a lattice hid for her lover to kiss the iron. And the wine shops half open at night. And the castanets in the night, we miss the boat at Algeciras. The watchman going about serene with his lamp, and oh, that awful deep down torrent, oh, in the sea, crimson sometimes like fire, and the glorious sunsets, and the fig trees, and the Alameda Gardens, yes, and all the queer little streets, and pink and blue and yellow houses, and the rose gardens, and the jessamine, and geraniums, and cactuses, and Gibraltar as a girl where I was, a flower of the mountain. Yes, when I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used, or shall I wear a red? Yes, and how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought, well, as well him as another. And then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes. And then he asked me, would I say yes, yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms round him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breasts all perfume, yes, and his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said yes, I will, yes!
This is East End Inc. We heard Sag Harbor's celebration of Blooms Day, recorded at the John Germain Library in Sag Harbor on June 16, 2022. The presenters were Joseph Shaw of the Express News Group of Sag Harbor in Southampton, stage and screen actor Paul McIsaac, impresario Peter Walsh, and actor Kate Muth of the group Neo-Political Cowgirls. East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasional 5th Wednesday at 6:30 a.m. and 8 p.m. here on WPKN. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com, and the podcasts are at soundcloud.com. Simply search for East End Inc. East End Inc. is produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Mary Ann Callender and Catherine Soka.